Hello, Anne Althouse.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi, welcome to the Glenn Show, Anne.
Thank you.
Anne Althouse, blogger extraordinaire. That's going to be my moniker for you.
Okay.
And law professor at the University of Wisconsin. And I'm Glenn Lowry, economics professor at Brown University. So thanks for coming on and talking, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
I thought that it might be interesting to kick around with you the subject of how President Obama is doing in the first year. Not that either one of us are necessarily, I don't know, you know, close followers of the Washington political scene or anything, but we're both reading the newspaper every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any doubt that it's been a tough patch for the president. I mean, I think of course, the Syria situation, the way in which the president has been criticized across the political spectrum and his administration for the handling of this issue about the chemical weapons, about the military strike, about whether a vote in Congress could have passed, about the last-minute arrival of a potential way of diffusing the situation, but the president's handling of it, his stature on the world stage, his credibility, all of these things seem to have been called into question. Likewise, the appointment that still has yet to be announced of a new chairman for the Federal Reserve,
right.
Public dispute, Lawrence Summers versus Janet Yellen, one I think has many reasons to be critical of the way in which that process has proceeded. I mean, the president getting, in effect, stymied by the left wing of his own party in the Senate, by all accounts, having to capitulate and not appoint the person that he would have wanted, and having the whole process get very public in ways that I think arguably might not be all that good for the Federal Reserve system and the Board of Governors and the sort of a, you know, putatively apolitical or at least not overtly political character of that body.
In both of those cases, it seems to be that he didn't fight and that he backed down. So that seems to be a pattern, and maybe it's something deviously clever that he is leading from behind in some way that is he doesn't really want things to look that good, and it's a technique that he's using in some amazing way. Or I know I'm just falling into the stereotypical, whatever Obama does, it must be brilliant, which has kind of gotten him a long way in life thus far. But do you think there's any argument that maybe he meant to do that, as Pee Wee Herman said in Pee Wee's Great Adventure, when he fell off his bike?
It doesn't look like that to me. You know, again, I'm not an expert on the inside baseball of Washington politics, but it, I mean, I heard Andrew Sullivan vigorously make the argument on the Syria case. It's a good outcome. Well, it remains to be seen whether it's going to be a good outcome or not. It's a process. And that, you know, the president wasn't rolled by Vladimir Putin quite the other way around. Again, from my perch, I don't quite see it that way. I mean, it doesn't look like Russian stature and look like Putin got what he wanted there, which was that the U.S. military didn't assert itself vis-a-vis the Russian client. And that the United Nations, you know, charter wasn't sort of run roughshod over by the U.S. Acting in a unilateral fashion militarily, which seemed to me to have been what Putin would want. So, you know, that sounds too clever by half to me. That sounds, you know, oh, the president's really being in an indirect way, and, you know, he's not that kind of guy. He's not a blustering kind of confrontational guy, but, you know, whatever. I don't know. I mean, I, you know, the alternative hypothesis is that, well, he's just not handling it very well, and he's kind of bumbling, stumbling along. That he's a weak leader, that he's indecisive, that he lacks resolve, that he doesn't have a doesn't really have a global vision that he's prepared to act on about American power, that he's kind of managing in a piecemeal fashion.
Right.
The campaign has been over for a long time, but that his primary modality is his strong suit. Is a campaign suit and
campaign.
A rhetorical suit,
right.
And it's not the strategic, visionary kind of global leadership suit. Well, and I think the evidence actually weighs in favor of this latter hypothesis, that he just hasn't been doing the job very well.
Well, when he's in a campaign, he knows what his goal is. It's winning. So he needs to win, and he's been good at that. The argument's been made that maybe he's sort of empty inside as to any kind of goals other than that he wanted to have this position and this power, but he doesn't have maybe any particular thing that he needs to do with it. In which case, you can't fail. You know, you win if you don't really have a side. How can you fail? How can you stumble? Of course, the other party is going to try to portray him as stumbling, and people in his own party who want him to do particular things are going to get on his case as well. But it's possible that he's doing exactly what he wants to do. It's possible that what he wants to do is perhaps nothing. Am I falling into the fawning, Andrew Sullivan-style fawning over Obama, that whatever he does is just fine?
No, it doesn't sound like fawning at all. I don't think that's an implausible conjecture. And that, in fact, is what I think he has kind of said, isn't it? I mean, he's,
Maybe he's a facilitator and a mediator. Maybe those hope posters actually had more meaning and a kind of an emptiness than anybody really realized. Everyone was able to pour what they wanted into him. He was our mirror in some ways. And it was that very abstraction and lack of specific goals that made everybody able to embrace him the way they did and to love themselves as they embraced him. You know, if someone else is your mirror, you know, you are loving yourself as you embrace him. So people really got into that emotional activity. And it worked. Maybe it worked because he wasn't very goal-oriented and that he was a mediator and a bringer of people together. I mean, maybe the greatest disappointment is that he hasn't brought us together more, as opposed to he hasn't bullied along and fought for specific goals.
Well, his defenders are going to say he tried very hard to bring us together, but the other side was implacable and its opposition has been and continues to be. You know, I was not a big fan of Larry Summers from a maybe ideological point of view, too close to the bankers in Wall Street and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I would really have liked to have seen the president defend the idea that Larry Summers was the right person for the chairmanship of the Fed
mm-hmm.
by taking on directly his critics on the left from Elizabeth Warren on and saying what it was about the, you know, I mean, after all, as a matter of fact, he did have Larry Summers at his right hand for the first couple of years of during this height of this crisis and all
mm-hmm,
the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And by everything that I've been able to read or discern, he and the people close to him on the economic policy side mm-hmm. think very highly of Larry Summers and would have wanted him to be in this position as chair.
Mm-hmm.
So that the president did not engage frontally, take control of that process, define what it was that he was about, and justify it, I think left us poorer than we otherwise might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why it is that you are so close to all these people on Wall Street and that you have, you know, I mean, he's going to say Dodd-Frank, he's going to say, you know, increased regulation, he's going to say, you know, we fought hard to get it to no more too big to fail or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that there was something kind of missing in the president's leadership on that. Not that that's a huge issue, but I don't know. How did you, and did
right, I'm just saying that
a position on this Larry Summers, Janet Yellen thing, and you know, yeah. a woman as the chairman of the Fed.
I don't fall for that.
Affirmative action for women.
I think it's too important to just make points on affirmative action. I mean, and we've done this so many times. No, I'm not going to get excited that it could be a woman leading the Fed. I want the right person to do it. I don't know enough about all of these issues
yeah.
as you do to really have a preference between the two. But I think if Obama, apparently these two are very different on what the policy is. And it does seem, well, the person is supposed to be kind of neutral, right? So the president shouldn't be selecting someone to install the policy that he wants, or should he, at this point, appointing.
Oh, I guess he's going to be electing someone whose judgment he trusts
mm-hmm.
and whose general orientation is simpatico with his view of the world.
But there was a very specific policy at issue that is being fought about as between these two candidates, right?
Well, yeah, it's the Fed's aggressive buying of debt in order to keep interest rates down, the so-called quantitative easing program, which has been controversial, in which I gather, although Summers has not taken any explicit public position on, that the betting money was that he would be relatively less liberal or more quick to pull back the reins on that.
Right.
Or as between him and Janet Yellen, more, you know, wary of the possibility of inflation coming back, more skeptical about imposing stricter regulations on banks, particularly on the, you know, amount of capital they have to hold in reserve and, you know, sort of reduce their leverage or something. But all of this is sort of implicit. I mean, it's not as if, you know, there's a position paper for these candidates about how they were going to conduct the policy.
Right, because that would be wrong. That would make the nomination process look corrupt if it were, I'm selecting the policy and then Congress is voting on that policy and then we have that policy installed at the Fed. I mean, that I would compare that to nominating judges where you don't come right out and say, these are the issues, we want them to decide our way. You say things in a much more abstract way and then you trust the person's judgment, as you said, and so forth. And that's what you purport to be really doing, but secretly you might be doing something else.
Summers has gotten a bad rap because he, you know, was president of Harvard and he was arrogant and loudmouthed and disaffected a lot of the faculty and he failed in that position.
He said something about women. Well, so there's this whole,
well,
you know, the gender politics.
That I think is really a bad rap. And what he was at a National Bureau of Economic Research conference and he was making some off the cuff remarks about research on gender differences in success in the technical sciences and mathematics. And in reviewing possible explanations for the observed fact that women are underrepresented in these fields, he allowed us how it might be because the distribution of native aptitude differed between men and women. And the difference needn't have been at the mean, just to bear with me for a minute, it needn't be that men were on average smarter. It might just be that the distribution for men was more variable than the distribution of this aptitude trait for women. So it had fatter tails so that you have more men in prison, you have more men with learning disabilities, you have more men at the bottom end of the distribution, and perhaps also proportionately there would be more men at the top if the hypothesis that the aptitude trait had a distribution for men that was fatter in the tails than the distribution of women.
Right, yeah.
He didn't say it was true. He just said that
but also,
hypothesis that might account for the difference.
So here's
a fact.
That, and
it's just ridiculous that someone would be regarded as sexist for making that observation.
But look at what happened politically to him as he was driven out. It was basically, I mean, I think there's some things about race as well that are like this. There are some issues. Don't even look into that. Even if there are facts there to be discovered, we don't even want to know them. We have something that we must believe as a matter of principle in a political manner. We don't want to know the truth. You know, there's a lot of talk about who's the party of science and the smart people are for science and so on, but there are a lot of scientific things we don't want to know. If X were true, we wouldn't want to know it. If X were true, we would deny it. And equality between the sexes is one of those things that we're supposed to take as an article of faith. It's kind of a modern day religion. And he was a heretic. To even say, here's a fact that needs explanation, here's an array of possible hypotheses, can we examine them? The answer was, don't even suggest that we should examine that one hypothesis. We don't want to know what's behind that closed door. You can't open that door. In fact, you're out the door, and that's the end of it. That's what was taught, right? Yeah. That was the lesson for Larry Summers. Now, he subsequently ascended with Obama, but, you know, the...
Here's what people would say. They'd say, well, look, he's president of the university, and it was not, you know, he's not the researcher who's reporting on something, and he's the leader of an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to maintain a certain decorum or a certain bearing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a weak argument at the end of the day. And I think you're basically right. There's a kind of know-nothingism or, you know, willful ignorance or a kind of quarantine on inquiry. You know, don't ask the question. We don't want to know the answer. That does sometimes operate. And you know, Steven Pinker, the great psychologist, wrote a whole book about this. He called it the blank slate, you know, and this... You know, a refusal to acknowledge what it is that we're increasingly coming to learn about, you know, human nature and the, you know, what our situation is in terms of the biochemistry and the genetics and the evolutionary and so forth, and gender differences that might bear on modern outcomes of interest are among those areas that, you know, racial differences too, that are kind of taboo or that are shrouded with this idea that we think we know a priori what the answer is. You know, the answer is equality. The answer is there is no difference, no difference that could matter.
Gender differences.
As a matter of fact, we don't necessarily know that. Those are scientific questions that require an inquiry in order to determine.
And, you know, even when they do, to some extent, try to study gender difference, they always report the results, or they twist the results, or they twist the testing itself in such a way that you can see that they have to show that they really believe what you should believe, which is at least that women are equal. But any difference is... Oh, I've been observing this for years, and some places on the internet, they refer to this as the Althaus rule, but whenever they're reporting results of any kind of test that shows a gender difference, they always spin it so that whatever is true of the female is good. So, and you can test it out, because imagine the results came out the different way and what had been true of the female was true of the male and the other way around. They would say that the other thing was the good thing. So, you know, you just see that all the time. There's a real fear there. People who are in the sciences act like they are devoted to truth. But it's obvious to me that there are many things that people don't want to say if they're true. They're afraid of getting in trouble. Look at all the trouble Summers got into. I mean, that was a highly disciplining political event that affected what many people have done since then. It wasn't just about Summers. It's about everybody.
Well, there are many areas about which this is the case. I mean, the climate change debate, of course, is very fraught in the same way. And, you know, there are other, the evolution question. how about teaching evolution and what's in the textbooks and all of that? But
also, I mean, the question of why does religion survive in a world of science? I mean, you could say, why do people still believe in God? People don't want to hear that there is no God. Well, the reason evolution...
Oh, wait, hold on. I can't follow you there.
Well, the reason...
I don't think that... I agree with you that people don't want to hear that there is no God, and that there's a lot of kind of tyrannical anti-intellectualism around the religious community. But what I don't agree with is that that's the same phenomenon as the phenomenon of not wanting to know whether there are gender differences in the natural constitution of human beings that bear on women and men's outcomes.
I think the reason
I say that is because there are whole books out there in which people are arguing. There's this philosopher, Plantinga, Plantinga, but I may not be getting his name right, who is arguing that there's no real incompatibility between religion and science. That,
right. That's what people want. Talk about things people want to hear.
Well, I mean,
look at evolution.
Properly, in fact, I did get his name right. It's Alvin Plantinga, and the book is called Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. I'm holding it in my hand right now, because I just happen to have had it on my table. So, I've been looking at it, and it's interesting to me. He says, you know, let me not try to summarize his argument. It's
you get him on Blogging Heads.
Complex and whatever. But the only point I'm trying to make is, whereas there is a lot of ignorance in religious communities, there are also a lot of very thoughtful people for whom the question of whether or not God exists is not a scientific question. But because they are either agnostic or credulous about the existence of God, doesn't mean that they reject. I mean, they don't have to reject I mean, it is the major humanistic intellectual achievement of the last, 500 years, the rise of science and the expansion of our understanding of nature and of ourselves and the environment.
But I think
reject that is to reject our humanity. This is one of Plantinga's points. I mean, if we're created in God's image, perhaps knowing and the capacity to know is a part of that creation. I don't have to sacrifice the one for the other. Anti-science as a religious person isn't a way to be anti-God on this argument.
Right, but that's a popular view. But listen to my point. That's a popular view, and I'm sure he sold a lot of books because it's something people want to hear. People think they believe in science, they're devoted to science, and they probably would say, truth above all. I put truth first. But there are many things, and believing in God is one of them, where people would not put truth first. There are some things that we put above truth that we would refuse to believe, despite all evidence that it wasn't true. I'm not saying
so
that.
So you're saying the that God doesn't exist is something that's
true
about
God? No, I'm not saying that.
Can prove something?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm
okay,
saying
that.
Because
I wanted to hear that argument.
I'm trying to say, no, I'm not going there. But, you know, there are the opposition to teaching evolution in schools that people have, or not teaching it along with creationism, is that it feels to a lot of people like you're teaching that there is no God unless you include the idea that God was somehow guiding evolution. And that isn't taught in schools. That's considered intellectual design or creationism. And attempts to include that along with evolution have been rebuffed by the courts as being religious. But but people feel a strong need to preserve certain traditional principles or certain views that they think are central to holding society together, like the equality of the sexes or racial equality, or that there is a God. I mean, we could have different points like that that people might have this feeling about. All I'm trying to say is that despite our praise of science, our professed devotion to science and to truth as the highest value, truth isn't the highest value, because you run across the places where truth is subordinated to other things. And that's why books like the one you just described are eagerly awaited. They're very interested in something Einstein said about believing in God or something like that. That's something that people want to hear so badly. And I think that if you have people who are engaged in science, the actual scientists who are doing the work, if as they work and try to do the scientific method, they also know who's making the career decisions within academia, who's handing out the grants, how that discipline works, you can see where that's pulling you. I mean, you can say 99% of climatologists agree, but why do they agree? Do they agree because of the science and the truth, or do they agree because there were political forces, monetary forces, that pulled them along to believe that there are things more important? Your one's own career, one's own peace of mind, one's money. There are things people find more important than the truth.
Yeah, but nevertheless, the truth will out. I mean, the force has been over a very long period of time now to ever expand the realm of knowledge. I mean, the scientific frontier has just pushed forward and forward and forward. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's been persecution and suppression and rejection of the finding of science since forever, you know. Galileo, Copernicus, whatever. I mean, but that hasn't stopped.
But what are the things today?
What the genome consists in. I mean,
but what are the things?
I'm not sure I get your point. I agree that there do exist these short run encumbrances.
Mm-hmm.
I take that point. I think that is a feature of our political/intellectual environment. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they ultimately went out. I think truth ultimately.
I think that there are some psychological walls that ultimately exist within. I mean, one thing that's scientifically true is that we're animals, that we're organisms, that we're born and that we're going to die. And there are limitations in our ability to function as sane human beings that put some boundaries on us, that give us some needs that we have that are superior to what's actually true. Now, we might still say, we're devoted to truth, but the assertion that you're devoted to truth isn't a truth. It's not a truth. It's a questionable proposition. We fall back from it when we're challenged on deep psychological, emotional, spiritual matters where we have needs, and we have needs because we live in the world, which is a fact, a truth.
No, I see that. And so that is a part of our psychological makeup, and it's that tension within any one of us as individuals with our acknowledgement and acceptance of the truth. But I'm saying that as a collectivity, don't we nevertheless find and propagate the truth? I mean, about whatever it might be, climate change, or whether or not the earth is the center of the universe, or you know, whether or not human beings have evolved from other forms of life.
Don't
we ultimately find our way to the truth?
Well, we're not in Galileo's time. We're in our time. So with respect to the things that we're clinging to that may not be true, we don't have that much insight into it. we have our limitations. But one of our, but it is nice that we believe in science and searching for the truth. What's an example? I'll point to what happened to Larry Summers.
A specific example where you think we're, you know, really in a bad way because people are averse to acknowledging.
Oh, I don't know if we're, we may not be in a bad way. It may be central to civilization and to human beings being able to stand to live in the world that we embrace a certain amount of falsehood and that we resist the hard truth. You know, I think that there are some gloomy souls who commit suicide or who can't really function very well in the public sphere where you see them, who are more devoted to the truth. But to, in order to live and work and plan for the future and have children and do all the things that keeps everything going, certain falsehoods are embraced because they're useful.
Okay.
I think that's true. Is that true? I'm presenting that as a truth. Do you like that? Or is that a truth that you
I think we're going to fall into some kind of logical, you know, can any claim, even claims about truth, be true and all this kind of thing? And I self-referential paradoxes. So why don't we move on to the next subject?
Let's run away from that one. Okay. Enough said. Close that door. We're closing the doors. Okay.
Yeah,
door closed.
Close the door on that one.
I'll close that door. Okay.
For the time being.
All right. Okay.
So we're going to talk about profiling or something?
Well, I was looking at this.
You had an interesting observation
of you. I thought of you yesterday because I was reading this article in the New York Times called Frisking Tactic Yields to a Focus on Youth Gangs. This is an article about New York. There was a case that was tried and the judge reached a decision last month about the New York City stop and frisk police practice.
Yeah, this is Judge Judith Heinlein, who is a federal, a federal district court judge, and who ruled that
it was a bench trial.
Policing tactic of stop and frisk was unconstitutional, violated
right.
the.
So she was a trier of fact and the law.
Fourth and 14th Amendment rights
bench
of
trial.
Black and Latino in New York City.
Right. So it was, they were targeting high crime neighborhoods, right? And but the high crime neighborhoods had a higher population of Black people. So the statistics of who was getting searched under this policy were racially skewed. Now, what do you say about the truth of all that?
Well, whether or not the actual implementation of stop and frisk, which the judge held to be unconstitutional, was what you say it was, which mm-hmm. was we target high crime neighborhoods regardless of their race. It just happens that they are more.
Right.
You know, were these stops always happening in high crime neighborhoods that just happen to be more. I don't know. I don't know as a factual predicate whether or not there is evidence in the record of racial profiling that comes about not as the indirect result of high crime neighborhood profiling, because high crime neighborhood profiling is presumably, at least conceptually, distinct from racial profiling.
Right. Right.
You just happen to be a non-white, but actually I'm in a high crime neighborhood.
Right. This is the same problem
so,
we have.
But let me grant that. Let's stipulate that that's actually what was going on. You're asking me whether what is a true about that. Because the question wasn't whether that tactic was effective. The question
was whether
it was
an unreasonable.
That tactic violated
right.
people's constitutional rights.
Unreasonable search.
Which is a
and
different
seizure.
Question, of course.
Yeah. But
so it might be true that the tactic was, in other words, I don't have to deny the truth of the fact that there are high crime neighborhoods that stopping people peremptorily or with weak probable cause is an effective tactic at deterring crime, mm-hmm. and that the byproduct of having done so is to stop many more Blacks per capita than whites per capita in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to deny the truth of any of that to follow a federal judge's argument that that practice, when institutionalized in a city of 8 million people, is violative of the Fourth and 14th Amendment rights of the citizens of New York.
That was a judgment
about the constitutionality of the practice, not
right.
about its effectiveness.
But the legal question is complicated. It was a long trial, and she was also the trier of fact. So I'm not going to pretend
to pull that apart. I wasn't at the trial.
But mm-hmm. I'm just in the political debate about stop and frisk, and we should note that Bill de Blasio just won the Democratic primary in the mayoral race and is in all likelihood going to be the next mayor, that he opposed.
And that he has publicly said that he would do away with the stop
right.
and frisk tactics.
Right.
He's criticized the Bloomberg right. administration
and so
Commissioner
in
Ray Kelly for their practice.
So quite aside from the law, politically, New York has rejected this. New York doesn't like the way it looks that the neighborhoods that got targeted were black neighborhoods. And the response, but these are the high crime neighborhoods, is just something people, it's not as important as how wrong it looks when people feel that they're being targeted racially, even if they're not, right? So if they're not targeted racially, even if as a fact they're not, wait, let me put this hypothetical out there. Even if we were to know as a fact that they weren't targeted racially, but the neighborhood still got targeted and it made people feel that they were being targeted racially, the feeling would be important and would be something we would put ahead, even of this factual matter that could be proven at trial, if it could be, that the neighborhoods were chosen because they were high crime. And people don't want to get into that. They just say this is the wrong policy because of the way it makes people feel, because of the way it looks. And those looks are more important than what actually happened. Politically, pick a different policy.
I don't
agree
with you, Ann. Give me an opportunity to state my case here. So you are a law-abiding person, you're black, and you live in a high-crime neighborhood in which the police are stopping people
mm-hmm.
randomly on the street and searching them, and you're stopped and you're searched. You're detained, yeah. You're inconvenienced, you're surveilled,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Now, the distinction between you're having this experience because the person sees that you're black and then comes to you, or you're having this experience because you happen to be black in an area in which many people happen to be black, and it's the area, not the blackness, that's been designated. That's a distinction without a real difference for the person who has been stopped.
Right. So that's a perspective.
Now you're saying of these people who object to this,
mm-hmm.
or of sympathetic outsiders who see the treatment that they're receiving and object to them having received that treatment, that somehow these people are in denial about, or are simply operating on feeling and not reasoning about. I don't think that's...
No, let me be clear.
I don't think that's accurate,
okay.
Because I think,
well,
I think that I could
saying.
Still object. I could still say... It doesn't just have to be that I feel that I've been pursued because of my race.
Uh-huh.
The objective fact is I'm bearing this burden. You know, that might be violative of my rights. My right to be, to not have the state impose its footprint on me and on my life in that way. I mean, those questions seem to me to be independent. The question of whether or not the motivation of the police department in fighting crime, having done a calculation, is to deploy its forces in a particular way.
Right.
And the question of whether or not the burdens borne by people who suffer the depredations of those forces do or do not violate their rights seem to me to be independent questions. So, okay, so that's my case. Thank
well,
you
you're kind of assuming the fact in issue, which is that it's a rights violation. That's the question we're asking, but we're not really in a position to ask it in a completely legal way. So I find it a little hard to approach it by saying, but don't violate my rights, because it's an issue of what are the rights? And that's still an issue. So I agree.
Oh, no.
Don't
well,
the
federal
rights.
Judge has ruled, and then maybe she'll be overturned on appeal.
Wait, how do we define
I was just saying that to take that position didn't make me to be someone who was hiding from the truth or unwilling to look at
No, let me be clear about what I was saying about hiding from the truth. And that is that the argument which Bloomberg and his police force made was, we're prioritizing neighborhoods with high crime. That's why we went there. We didn't do it because of race. If we had gone to other neighborhoods, we would have actually been discriminating based on race, because we might have said, it's going to look bad if we go to the black neighborhoods. It'll look like it's racial targeting. But in fact, those are the neighborhoods that come up on top when we look at incidents of crime. So if we applied a neutral standard, we would go to those neighborhoods. But if we apply a race-conscious standard, we should actually go somewhere else so that people don't feel that they're targeted.
I want to explain why that's a bogus argument,
mm-hmm.
okay? I have heard the mayor of New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and I have heard his police commissioner, Commissioner Ray Kelly, make this argument in public.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bogus argument in my view. The argument is that if you looked at the homicide statistics, the racial representation in and by the way, this is not a neighborhood argument. This is a racial argument.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're not saying neighborhoods. They're saying the race, but they've made this argument in public. The racial composition of the victims and of the perpetrators, so far as we can tell, of homicides is some number. Let's say it's 9 to 1 or 10 to 1. I don't know the exact number. It's a number.
Mm-hmm.
the racial disproportion of the stops that we've taken is some other number. Okay, let's say it's 6 to 1. Again, I make the number up, but I'm giving the form of their argument. Therefore, if anything, we're under, you know, we're not stopping enough in terms of the disproportion blacks, because the racial disproportion in our stops is in some way or another justified by the racial disproportion in the criminal offending. Now, the reason that that's a bogus argument is that almost nobody is a criminal offender. When I say almost nobody, I mean the vast majority of the population are not offenders. So the racial disproportion in the 1 in 1,000 people who are actually going to commit a criminal assault has very little to do with the racial disproportion in the 100 in 100 people who were being stopped.
And 90% of the people or something like that were searched.
For someone to make the judgment that those 99 or 999 non-offenders who were detained, inconvenienced, humiliated, rousted, have their privacy violated, that it's not justified, that it's not warranted, that it's not legitimated by the racial disproportion amongst the offenders is a prudential and moral judgment that it seems to me a sensible person might arrive at. It's one that I hold myself.
You know, another point is that the ones who were the 10% or whatever it was who, in fact, were found in violation when they were searched, what they were in violation of, I think, were basically gun laws. Well, also drug, but gun laws. And it might be that if you live in a dangerous neighborhood, you would illegally carry a gun just for self-defense. So some of this overlaps with issues about gun control. What is the crime you're really concerned with? Should it be just the gun crimes? Because people who are tempted to carry a gun and to disrespect the law enough not to meticulously follow the gun laws, some of those are people who are afraid of being victims. And they're in a high crime neighborhood, you're more afraid of being a victim. So I think that complicates it, and it makes the statistics even worse as far as the people who were searched, that they weren't actually committing crimes. I'm not trying to defend this stop and frisk policy, but let me be clear about that. I'm just trying to say that there are certain facts that we exclude and don't want to think about. We want to solve the problem from a different direction, that to, for example, say black neighborhoods, or if there was an incidence of crime among black people, if there was some scientific reason showing that there was a propensity, nobody would want to hear that. That would be rejected. If that were true, people would ostracize anybody that found that to be true.
You know, that's very high. If a certain fact were true, then we speculate that people wouldn't want to. I don't want to argue that with you. You're probably right about that. But in any case.
But you see my point? That's a
truth. Let me say something
here, Anne. If that were a fact, people would exclude it.
Please, give me a chance. I wanted to underscore a couple of things that you just said that I thought were important. One was that the main attraction from the stop and frisk is finding weapons. That, you know, even though you don't find that many of them, I mean, I'm pretty sure that that's the case, that, and also establishing a presence so that people don't carry the weapon.
Exactly.
I mean, it can go in either way. I might carry a weapon because I think I'm going to encounter somebody with a weapon, and so I'm trying to defend myself. And that's a bad equilibrium. You know, that's a self-sustaining thing, right? I mean, if I think that no one is carrying a weapon out there, I don't need to carry, so an equilibrium with no one carrying can hold. Yeah. But if I think that most people are carrying, then maybe I want to carry, so an equilibrium with most people carrying can also hold. And that's, you know, that's a bad thing. And you don't need to find that many guns, perhaps, in order to make a dent on the level of violence. And it may also be that people who own guns, but who in going to the party think they might get stopped on the way home from the party, don't carry their gun onto the street and to the party because they don't want to lose their gun or get, you know, detained by police or arrested. And as a result, they don't have the gun so that when they're drunk at the party, they don't shoot somebody. And maybe that also reduces violence. It's not implausible that there could be benefits from the stop and frisk. It's a judgment that our society has to make. And I think you're right. New Yorkers have made it politically as to whether or not those costs and benefits, you know, warrant to undertake the policy.
They would like to make you believe, the police would like to make this policy work. The ultimate goal is to make everybody believe that if you carry a gun, the police are going to find out. And everybody already knows this, so nobody's carrying guns anymore. So now we're all safe. And now we don't feel that we need to protect ourselves. The government has protected us. I mean, that's the liberal goal with gun control, that the police have taken over protection. You don't have to protect yourself anymore. I just got an email from the University of Wisconsin, because they have to email us about all the crimes, that a woman was held up at night at gunpoint on campus at 1:30 last, and it was last night, and we were informed she gave up her purse to the assailant, and he got away, and we're told, don't resist, give up if a gun is ever pointed at you. Well, that's kind of interesting. That's basically saying anybody that wants to go around in the middle of the night with a gun is going to get total compliance from everybody. But, you know, what are you supposed to make out of that? I mean, do you believe?
It's a hard problem, is what I make out of it.
And on campus, we want to believe, we nice liberal white people, and there are some, an occasional, there are a few black people here, but mostly white people in this neighborhood, around campus, think the police are going to protect them from everything. And they want to believe in a world where the police will be there and will save them. Well, there are other people who, speaking of rights, believe in Second Amendment rights, including a Second Amendment right to carry a gun in self-defense. So maybe
Let me respond this way, Anne.
If you care about not violating rights, what about that?
Let me respond this way. I think it's a hard problem. Do you teach people to resist when they are accosted? Or do you teach them to submit? I grant that if the offender anticipates that the victim will submit without resistance, then that will be an incentive to offend. So a world in which it's broadcast that people who are going to be robbed are have been taught are likely not to do anything but to give in, is a world where there will be more robbers, other things equal. I think that that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I have two responses in favor of the idea of teaching people not to resist.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, as a practical matter, it may be the prudent decision in a given situation, even though the net effect of everyone following this decision would be deleterious.
Mm-hmm.
That is, resistance is futile. That's what the board would say on Star Trek. No, but that is to say, you know, we could do a calculation and it just might be true. It's an empirical question. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm just saying it could be true that the net effect of resistance was that more people end up getting hurt and that, you know, you didn't get rid of robbery because you were resisting,
mm-hmm.
but the effects of the robberies that occurred when people were resisting were deleterious. So that's one kind of reason why you might tell people not to resist. The other reason, I was recently visiting some friends who live in rural New Mexico. I mean, in a beautiful, spectacular place. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very isolated on a family ranch that's been handed down across the generations. And they've got a gazillion acres, and you can see mesas and mountain ranges and all this stuff from their front porch, and it's spectacular.
Wow,
and
nice.
As I was driving to this location from Santa Fe, New Mexico, I realized what you were just talking about, which was, if somebody tries to mess with me, no one is going to come to help.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think differently about guns, and it really did.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think, how would I tell somebody not to carry a gun around here?
You know? I bet you.
I mean, there is nobody to call. There's no one to call.
Didn't your friends have guns?
Let me finish the statement. If you took it upon yourself to, I'm going to answer that question. If you took it upon yourself to, you know, say, I'm the guy who's in charge of my defense over here because there is nobody else to defend me. The state is way too remote and it's me or nobody at all. And so I'm ready. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I would understand that completely. Now, I got to my friend's house, and having had that thought as I was driving up through this spectacular, desolate country, I said to them, I said, do you guys have a weapon here?
Yep.
And they said, no. Now, they were there for the summer. They lived there in the summer. But there's an in-law that lives there all year round, and she does not have a weapon. And I began to talk to her about it. And
does she
says,
have dogs?
It's a conscious decision. It's a spiritual argument. She doesn't want a weapon. She says, violence begets violence. She says, if I have a weapon here, I'll have to use it.
Okay? Maybe you shouldn't.
Now, that's not a utilitarian calculation. I'm sorry. I you know, that's a stand about how I'm going to live in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and a person could take that stance. I mean, it's not the stance I would take personally. But when I saw the principled character of the way in which this woman announced that she didn't keep a weapon there, I thought, okay, well, I hope no one comes over your fence.
Seriously, are you sure you should even put this up online? You're saying that a woman year-round lives alone with no weapons in a very isolated place. I would.
It's New Mexico, man. It's a big. It's a big state. I didn't identify anybody's name. I just said it was within. You know,
state X.
It's an hour's drive from Santa Fe. I mean, that includes quite a large amount of territory, and I'm sure she's not the only one.
Okay, now I feel like I need to say something about why I said this article reminded me of you, lest people think I had some.
Go ahead, and then let's close out.
In our last dialogue, I think it was. We were talking maybe about a similar subject, and you said that when you were up living maybe around Columbia University or something like that, that you got cited for, the police cited you for riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, and that you regarded that as racially discriminatory. You felt that the police had profiled you. But, and so,
again, whether they were just doing it because I was on 113th Street near Malcolm X Boulevard, and that's one of their neighborhoods, or whether they were doing it because I was black, seemed immaterial to me. The fact was I was detained coming out of my place because
right. now,
I was riding my bicycle
so
on the sidewalk.
In the middle of this article, which is about how after that case was decided on stop and frisk, that they've switched over to some other methods. And I don't know if you want to get into the details of talking about that method, but there are hundreds of police officers in New York who spend a lot of time pretending to be young women online so they can get friended by so-called crew members on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and so on, so that they can get beyond the privacy settings and look and try to see what's up with people and who's friends with who and where the criminal conspiracies are, and everybody that's friends with everybody else then is being investigated by the police, like maybe they're in a conspiracy with them. And this is the alternative to stop and frisk. So if you take away stop and frisk, what else are they going to do? There's something lame and just disgustingly invasive about this. But I got to the paragraph that said the strategy is not only the way the department uses social media to bolster cases, but it's proven particularly effective, despite being widely publicized, for the simple reason that an online persona is in other words, everybody has to be online. They organize these things online, so they can't go offline anymore. And so they end up being friends with police officers and so forth who have lured them into it by pretending to be women, young women. But then they say veteran officers keep lists of teenagers believed to be affiliated with crews. On the street, officers might pick them up for truancy or issue summonses for biking on the sidewalk to reinforce the notion that the police are watching. So in other words, there are these neighborhoods where they think these crews, they don't call them gangs, they call them crews because they're apparently smaller and less well organized, but they want the sense to be created that the police are everywhere. And the stop and frisk policy did that. And this invasion into Facebook and other social media, with not done secretly, but openly talked about, we're in there, we're watching you. That's similar to this other technique, which included explicitly giving out summonses for biking on the sidewalk. So the idea is to make people feel the police are everywhere, the police are watching. There are different ways you can do that. If you take away stop and frisk, something else will be done. But I thought it was very interesting that biking on the sidewalk, the very issue that you had been felt targeted or were targeted by, was one of the things that's a specific technique in New York for creating the feeling, perhaps in certain neighborhoods or among black people, that the police are watching you. The police will see, just like the old God is watching.
Okay, and I guess I have a couple of responses. One is, I don't know that it is less creepy that I would have an army of employees of the New York City Police Department who have online personas infiltrating social networks, trying to develop online relationships of whatever sort with young people in New York City who are, maybe living in high crime neighborhoods, maybe gang affiliated, whatever it is. I don't know that it's less creepy that I've got an army of people pretending to be women in order to attract these guys and learn about them so that we can find out whether they've got guns and stop them from committing crimes, than it is to stop every third one who comes out of the housing project and, detain him, and, or everybody who's, I mean, it is a, it is a hugely invasive thing into the private lives of people. Mm-hmm. And the bureaucracy that's doing it, it just, it's a kind of chilling thing. I mean, are you
I agree.
I mean, so
yeah, that's what
if the point that you're making is you didn't like profiling, but look what this is going to be substituted for. It's not clear that it's a better world. I take note of that point. I mean,
I'm not making words in your mouth.
No, I'm just saying
there was an article in the, everything has consequences. So it's,
yeah.
If you say you can't stop people on the street and search them, which seems to be a more traditional form of invasion that is very, a kind of a hot confrontation with the police is very intimidating. If you say you can't do that, then maybe you like these subtle methods, which involve secretly finding out things about you, but also making it public that we're everywhere looking for things and you don't know where the cameras are and you don't know when we're in your account. And I might connect this up with the whole NSA surveillance issue. There are these alternatives. I'm not saying I like the alternatives better, or I like the hot invasion of one's privacy on the street.
There's also what the New York City Police Department anti-terrorism unit has mm-hmm. been doing, which I've heard reported on the mm-hmm. radio and in the newspaper, in investigating Muslim organizations,
mm-hmm.
student organizations on campuses,
mm-hmm.
mosque around the five boroughs of the city,
mm-hmm.
In an effort to identify people who might be susceptible to radicalization that would lead them to act in terrorism, infiltrating these organizations with informants,
mm-hmm.
and mounting various, sting operations or what you would call them. Maybe they're entrapments, but, you know, various scenarios in which people who might be inclined to want to do something are encouraged to develop those ideas and are provided with what they think are the means to carry out an act so that they can then be placed in a position where they would be arrestable. You know, they'd be subject to arrest for having violated law. But in any case, this is, I don't know, maybe this is just what the face of security in our time is going to look like. But I would welcome a much more vigorous public debate about how to think where the boundaries of this trade-off between, you know, our freedoms and our security should be established. I do think that's the question.
Well, that's
stop
the big,
and frisk.
Speaking of
the
things.
The question in stop and frisk is you can make those communities safer, but you can also make people's lives different to the extent that they are, you know, constantly reminded of the presence of the police.
Right.
And I think they are right to be able to make that kind of a judgment on how they want to bear those burdens and costs.
And now
the political process.
With respect to the terrorism, and to go back to Obama where we began, we really would like everybody in Al-Qaeda to believe that the federal government is watching them all the time, knows where they are, and can call, and Obama can point to the list, knows, has a list of your names, he's making a list, he knows who's been bad and good, he can point to your name, and we have a drone that could go kill you instantly wherever you are. If you're in Al-Qaeda, we know all about you, and we have a button that we can push and eliminate you anytime we want. Isn't that what we want them to think? I don't know whether that's true, but we are obviously trying to create that impression to destroy these terrorist networks by making it just completely paranoid and perhaps properly so. Now, I think
that's only one way of responding to the condition that we find ourselves in of being susceptible to terrorism. That is, this hyper-punitive law enforcement mechanism or anti-terrorism mechanism, if you like, in which people are deterred because we're going to zap you, we know who you are, and we're going to kill you. That's only one way. Another very different way would be, let me see if I can understand what the root of their violent reactions are and address myself in a more fundamental way politically to the sources of their agitation and so forth. I advocate neither method, but simply observe that there is a distinction to be drawn.
Right, and didn't a lot of people vote for Obama initially, thinking that he was somehow going to be able to talk to people and that he would be some transnational mind that would somehow be able to bring people together, that would make them stop hating us, and people would just turn away from terrorism. So he kind of surprised a lot of people doing that. But hasn't he done that pretty vigorously? And as far as the charge that he's an empty person with no particular goals.
He does keep
goals,
a list, and he checks it twice.
Doesn't he? I mean, one reason I voted for him in 2008 was that I thought, after all of the years of Democrats complaining about what Bush was doing in the war on terrorism, complaining from the sidelines when they weren't responsible for what happened, that if Obama were, if a Democrat were president, they would have to take responsibility and they would step up and do these things and they would reveal that the things they were complaining about Bush doing, in fact, were things that should be done. And I think Obama has proved that. So I have to say, as far as why I voted for Obama in 2008, he actually did the one thing that I wanted to see done.
Which was established that Bush was right to have taken the
posture. Not just that Bush was right, but that things needed to be done, and there's no lovey-dovey, couldn't we all just get along solution, that you have to take responsibility for this, that it is a military situation, and that some pretty hardcore, tough things need to be done. He did some really hardcore, tough things. And did he not
well,
do them
right? I don't know that the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, whose grandfather...
Right? Yeah.
Who's the son of Awlaki. Awlaki was the internet imam, American citizen operating out of Yemen, whom we killed, mm-hmm. whom our government killed because he's a terrorist and he was promoting terrorism. He was someone who had been influential on Abdul Muttalib, the underwear bomber of mm-hmm. Detroit, and who had been influential on Hassan, the mm-hmm. Shooter in Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And we killed him. And we also killed his son.
Right.
I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 weeks after we killed Anwar al-Awlaki, we killed his son. And the grandfather, Awlaki's father, the son's grandfather, wrote on the pages of the New York Times, I don't know why the American government killed my grandson.
Right.
Okay. So some of us are disappointed that the president of the United States conducting operations that end up killing. I mean, I don't know why. I've not heard it. Maybe there's an explanation that can be put forward to me.
Imagine if Bush had done.
In Yemen, the son of the internet imam, Anwar al-Awlaki, who was like kind of Tokyo Rose type that we had to take out.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we kill his son? I still don't know.
Well, one answer is that Obama can get away with doing things like that. Imagine if Bush had done that. Imagine the outcry. You know, you never hear about Cindy Sheehan anymore.
Your response is to say it would have been worse if Bush had done it, but I'm saying what was done was wrong.
Okay.
Or at least so far as I know. I mean, I need to be disabused of that, but it's all secret. It's all shrouded in this... you know, in a world in which we go around eliminating people because they have ideological hatred of us that might lead them to violence, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's...
Well, they're in a terrorist conspiracy.
Maybe we have no choice, but I remain to be persuaded of that.
They're in a terrorist conspiracy that has an articulated intent to destroy us, and they've conducted some huge attacks on us, and we've stopped some others. We need to keep stopping them. We want that. We don't want our children killed. And in war, innocent people get killed.
We're not at war. And we're not at war.
Well, so you want to say that the war on terror is not a war?
We're not at war.
The reason you can say
I do want to defend the position that we're not at war. We're in a condition. We're not at war.
The enemy hasn't surrendered.
There's not going to be a peace treaty somewhere. This is not...
The only reason you can say we're not at war is because we've been successful enough in the war we've conducted that we're not feeling any pain. But the war hasn't ended.
I'm saying it's a misuse of the metaphor or the construct of war. And anyway, can we do this in another blog? Yes, we've been talking for an hour. I've got to go do something else right now.
Okay.
Really appreciate you coming on the Glenn Show. And I don't think we agree about this, but we'll have to find out exactly what the nature of our disagreement is. In the next